Well, thanks for having me on this very hot afternoon. Now, I'm sure you've heard of C.S. Lewis. He's probably well known for the Narnia children's storybooks. But what his day job was, he was a philosopher at Oxford University. And in 1944, he gave a brief lecture, which he entitled The Inner Ring. And in this lecture, he argued that next to our fear of death, the single biggest motivation and driver in all of human existence is our desire for status and approval. Our desire to be respected and to be admired. And he summed this up in this lecture as the desire to be in the inner circle or the inner ring. So imagine, if you would, you're watching a group of school children playing in a school playing ground. Well, it won't take you long, will it, to discover which of the children are considered to be in the in crowd and which of those aren't. Or watch a bunch of students down a university bar along a big table. It won't take you long to discover which student it is that they'd all much rather be sitting next to rather than the person that they might be sitting next to at the moment. Or perhaps think about the dynamics in your own office. How long would it take to discover who it is who's considered top dog? Not often to do with people's job titles, is it? Well, C.S. Lewis argued that each of us, at different points in our lives, we have all found ourselves on one side or the other of that invisible social line, either desperately trying to get into that inner circle or desperately trying to stay in that inner circle. Well, about 15 years ago, another philosopher, this time an atheist, he observed the same sort of thing. A guy called Alain de Botton wrote a book called Status Anxiety, which is where I've got this title for this talk. And he observed how each of us, in our minds, we kind of construct these social hierarchies. We tend to value one another and then mentally place one another on these hierarchies. So imagine you're at a dinner party and you meet someone, and there's a tendency in us, isn't there, to take a small part of someone. It might be their physical appearance, it might be what their job is, it might be where they live or where they go on holiday. We take a small part of them, and then we can make a value judgment, a status judgment on that person. And once we've sort of mentally constructed that social hierarchy, what do? Well, we ruthlessly self-promote ourselves to get up it, or at least to try and stay at the top of it. And think about it for a moment. C.S. Lewis, Alain de Botton, I think they're onto something, aren't they? We do seek approval. We do crave respect. We do yearn to be in that inner circle, or at least to stay there if we're in it already. We play the status game. I think we do this at work. We do this in our social settings. We obviously do it on social media. And if we're Christians, we do it at churches. But I want to show you just how destructive this is. You'll see our first point on the handout there. We'll only find anxiety by playing the status game. So we're in John's Gospel, which is an eyewitness account of Jesus' life. And I think this narrative here in chapter 3 is going to help us immensely. Look down with me at verse 22, if you would. Verse 22. After this, Jesus and his disciples went into the Judean countryside, and he remained there with them and was baptizing. John also was baptizing at Aenon near Salim, because water was plentiful there. And people were coming and being baptized. So it seems as if business is looking good for John the Baptist. People were coming from all over the country. They would have been walking for weeks just to be baptized by him. And in fact, it seems as if so many people are wanting to be baptized by him that he has to recruit disciples to help him out in his work. And you can imagine these disciples, they would have been popular. They're in prestigious company. They've managed to corner the best baptism spot where there's plentiful water at Aenon near Salim, wherever that is. Life is good in John's inner circle. But then in verse 25, John's disciples get into an argument with one of their fellow countrymen. Perhaps they're trying to persuade this Jewish guy to ditch ceremonial washing and to get on board with this new thing, a new thing called baptism. But it seems as if this Jew wasn't persuaded by their sales pitch. He might have said, well, how can I know that you're the real thing when there's another baptism crew in town, a guy called Jesus and his disciples are doing the same thing just over there in the Judean countryside? So how do we know that you, John, and the disciples, that you're not just some spiritual fad? Well, when John's disciples, when they discover there's a rival baptism crew in town, it hits right at their hearts. They rush straight back to John the Baptist to report on the situation, and you can hear the status anxiety dripping off their words. Verse 26, Rabbi, he who was with you across the Jordan, to whom you bore witness, look, he's baptizing, and all are going to him. See, a moment ago, John's disciples thought they were top dog. They thought they were the market leader. But now they discover that Jesus' disciples are getting in on their game. And apparently everyone is now going over to Jesus instead. So they fear that Jesus' group are going to squeeze them into obsolescence, off the top of the pecking order, and out of that inner circle. John's disciples are playing the status game. But all they've won is anxiety. Now you might be sitting here thinking, okay, I think I know where this is going to go, but this isn't for me. I'm not as insecure as all that. I don't have status anxiety. Well, if you're up for this, let me just ask us three diagnostic questions, which just might help tease out whether that really is the case. Is a first question for us. Firstly, do you find yourself mentally comparing yourself to your peers? So imagine you stupidly decide to go to that university reunion, and you don't know why you go, but you're there. And on your table are two people next to you on the exact same course and the exact same field of work you're currently in. And you chat with the person to your left, and they're doing really, really, really well, much better than you. And your heart sinks just a little bit. And then you chat with the person on the right, and they're not doing so well at all. And suddenly you're sort of slightly elated by that discovery, slightly puffed up by it. I imagine, how do you react when you discover that someone in your office, someone who was once your junior, is now being promoted to your level, or perhaps above your level? What's your heart doing at that moment? Do you mentally compare yourself to your peers? Well, here's the second diagnostic question for us. How well do you respond to criticism or failure? So I mentioned earlier Alain de Botton, who wrote this book, Status Anxiety, in 2004. Well, there was a blogger called Caleb Crane who gave it a rather scathing review in the New York Times. And Alan was furious about this. And so he sent Caleb a private message, or at least he thought it was private. He accidentally stupidly managed to post it on his public blog post wall. And so everyone saw what Alan wrote. Here's what he wrote. Caleb, you make it sound on your blog that your review was somehow a sane and fair assessment. In my eyes, and to all those who have read it with anything like impartiality, it is a review driven by an almost manic desire to badmouth and perversely depreciate anything of value. The accusations you level at me are simply extraordinary. I genuinely hope that you'll find yourself on the receiving end of such a daft review in some time very soon, so that you can grow up and start to take some responsibility for your work as a reviewer. You have now killed my book in the United States, nothing short of that, all in one miserable 900-word review. I will hate you to the day that I die and wish you nothing but ill will in every career move you make. I'll be watching you with interest and schadenfreude. Now, it's pretty ironic, isn't it? The guy who wrote the book on status anxiety, he can't take a bad review. But are we any better? So imagine your boss, he calls you into his office to privately give you a little bit of constructive feedback. It's awkward, it's a bit painful, but fair enough. You deal with it. But then later that same day, in a public meeting, one of your peers repeats that exact same piece of feedback before everyone, and you're furious. Or maybe you're entrusted with a big, important presentation at work and you completely botch it up. It's a public fail and your heart sinks. But then the same day, one of your colleagues does a sterling piece of work. Well, are you able to bring yourself to compliment them on that piece of work? Or are you sort of refusing to let them climb that invisible hierarchy? Well, here's a final diagnostic question for us. Do you invest as much energy into unseen things that don't give you any status as you do seen things that do give you status? And I guess that's what we see happening here in verse 26. John the Baptist's disciples, they should have known that John's role was to point people to Christ, which meant that was their role too. But when they see everyone leaving them and going over to Jesus, well, they're gutted because they're more invested in their own status and their own little kingdom than they are in Jesus' status and his kingdom. And are we so different? Investing in perhaps what is seen to give us status rather than what is unseen, but more important. So I don't know, perhaps you see a dissonance perhaps between the amount of time and energy you put into investing your and building your status at work compared to the amount of time and energy you might invest in your spouse or your children. Or maybe you see some sort of dissonance between the way you treat people at work who are important, people who can give you status, and the people at work who aren't important and who can't give you any status. Now, I don't know if you recognise any sort of status anxiety in yourself, but as long as we are controlled by a desire to be on the inside of that inner circle, the irony is we're never going to get what we want. We'll never actually be satisfied. C.S. Lewis compared it to peeling an onion, trying to get into the inner ring. It's a bit like peeling an onion. If you succeed at getting to the center, well, you've got nothing left. And too many people have found that, haven't they, at the cost of their marriages, at the cost of their children, at the cost of their lives. So what's the solution then? Well, instead of finding anxiety playing the status game, we can find joy being Christ's friend. So John's disciples, they come back to him and complain that everyone's going over to Jesus now. And, well, in verse 27, he replies, well, that's the whole point. Did you see that, verse 27? John answered, a person cannot receive even one thing unless it's given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I've been sent before him. The one who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom, who stands and hears him, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is now complete. John here compares himself to being the best man at a wedding, or the friend of the bridegroom. Now, if you've ever been a best man at a wedding, you'll know your main job, of course, is to completely shred the groom in a public speech. That's the main role, isn't it? But back then, weddings were very different. If you think nowadays, it's usually the bride's father who walks her down the aisle to present her to the groom. But back in that culture, in fact, it was the best man who presented the groom to the bride. And that's what John's saying here. He's Jesus' best man. He's Christ's friend. So he gets his joy not from stealing the show, not from taking the bride and running off with her himself, but by presenting the bride, God's people, to Christ. He says, this joy of mine is now complete. Now, I think verse 30 is perhaps one of the most beautiful statements in the whole of the New Testament. Perhaps you agree. John says, speaking of Jesus, he must increase, but I must decrease. Imagine, if you would, that John the Baptist is the brightest star in the night sky. What is that, by the way? Is that the North Star? Let's say it's the North Star. And that's John. He's the brightest star. He's the last prophet of the Old Testament era. He's a big deal. But Christ is like the sun. And at the dawn of day, when the sun rises, well, what happens to the stars? Well, they're eclipsed by that superior light, aren't they? They don't die. They don't become obsolete. They don't explode or perish. that just fade into comparison. So John is not being really down on himself here. He's not saying, oh, my own person, my own ministry, it's just worthless. But he is saying that compared to Jesus, his own ministry and his own person, they are worth less. Now, we're not John the Baptist, are we? We aren't Jesus' best man in that unique sense. But if you're a Christian here today, we do have a role in pointing people to Christ. We're Jesus' friends in that general sense, which means we can make John's words here in verse 30 our very own. He must increase, I must decrease. Now again, I want to persuade you, this is really good news. Because it means that our sense of value and self-worth, it doesn't have to be determined by our job title or our salary packet or what we look like or where we are on that corporate ladder. Our value can be determined by our connection to the eternal Son of God. If he calls us his friends, then what else do we need? I found as our view of Jesus gets bigger and bigger, as he comes to occupy more and more of our vision, so our petty concerns for importance and they just begin to lessen and fade. This is my experience. I found that it's only once we're liberated from playing that status game. It's only once we are secure in the status that Jesus offers to us that we're able to rejoice at other people's successes. That we're able to take criticism and give compliments. That we're able to value the unseen things as well as the seen things. We'll find joy by being Christ's friends. But in my final moments, I just want us to see that the stakes are even higher than we might think. I'm sure you know plenty of people. I know plenty of people who seem to be perfectly happy without Jesus. But here's my final point. We can only find life in the Son. So in these final verses, which we're going to scoot over, we're invited to play a game of spot the difference. Whenever we're going driving in the car, my daughter is 3.5. She loves spot the different puzzles in her book. And we're invited to play spot the difference here, comparing John the Baptist's ministry with Jesus' ministry. We're told here Jesus has a higher perspective than John. He's from heaven, not the earth. He has a higher authority than John. He is above all. He has a higher responsibility than John. God has placed everything into his hands. And this comparison here is labored so that John's disciples, and so that us here this afternoon, so that we don't make that stupid decision of investing in that which is second best. Verse 36 draws the conclusion for us. Did you see that? Whoever believes in the Son has eternal life. Whoever does not obey the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God remains on him. You see, eternal life, true life, is not found in John's ministry, but nor is it found in playing the status game, by forcing our way ever further into that inner circle, by trying to make a name for ourselves. Look, we could do that. We could spend our whole lives trying to gain the world's approval, couldn't we? We could try and shoot to become the world's brightest star in our own particular field, to be the brightest star in the night sky. But no matter how bright we get, it's inevitable, isn't it, that one day we're going to be eclipsed with the rising of the sun. And then on that day, all our selfish and heartless pursuit of status, it's going to be exposed for what it is. And we'll have nothing to shield us from God's righteous anger. According to this verse, there's only one person whose approval really matters, and that's Jesus's. See, the eternal Son of God, think about it for a moment, he is the eternal Son of God. He has the highest status above all, doesn't he? And yet, for our sake, what did he do with that status? Well, he gave it up. He entered our world. And more than that, he went to the lowest point of all. He went down to the cross, where he was crucified on a Roman cross between two thieves. He lost his status. He gave it up. And he took on God's wrath in our place. He did that so that we might eternally share in his status. Status as children of God. I hope you're persuaded. Lasting joy is found in no one else. Eternal life is found in